This is 4:55 on Friday, September 16th. Good morning. So what's going on this morning that has a third of the people or more missing from this class and a third or more of the people missing from my earlier class?
It's a bright day and it's Friday.
It's a bright. Well, indeed, it's more comfortable. So I'll just point out for those who are here that we have 2 weeks from today, the first exam, and it's going to cover everything we've done so far plus what we're going to do in the next 2 weeks, which is chapter 3. So I thought we would start this morning with something that I was reminded of when I was talking to some folks who do recruiting. What? I am. Well, I've said that before and lied. So. I am. I was talking with some folks who recruit for a big company over on the west side yesterday, and they said that, you know, one of the early questions in their job interviews is closely related to the clicks questions for this morning. So, just so you know, these will also be important for the test. They were already on my list to do today, so it was kind of interesting that they should mention that. But anyway, let's see here. So one of the things that they do in their company is related to networking. So we've talked about the socket operations for TCP clients and servers. And so what are they? They ask this as an interview question. What order do you do them in? And so what do you think? These are the client operations. Would you like to poke your colleague there? Good morning.
Sorry.
We're at work here. So yes, socket, connect, send, receive, and close. That's the litany for the clients. Let's go on and ask about the servers. This one's harder a bit. Same question, servers. So maybe your strategy is to see what everybody else is voting for and vote for that. I don't know. That's one way to approach these things, but may not be the best for your own learning. Okay, good. That's fine. All right. Server code sends and receives on the socket returned by the socket system call. Now I'm getting tricky. If that happens again, maybe you'll donate it to me. All right, so maybe there's a little more disagreement here. So in the server pattern, what happens? Let's go back to the previous question. Don't answer this. Just putting it up to look at it. What happens in the server pattern? It's socket bind, listen, accept, send, receive, close. Where does the socket come from that we do the sends and receives on? From accept, yes. Accept returns a new socket that we can then do send and receive on. And what do we do again with what do we do with the socket that we get from the socket system call?
We use it to get a new connection.
That's the one that we use for the bind, the listen, and the accept. Yeah. Which system call returns the socket used by the client code for send and receive? Now it's not multiple choice. You have to actually tell me. Votes so far for connect, socket, bind, which is, I think, all three of the ones that are on the list before the actual send and receive. One for accept. Still waiting for a few more answers. Well, okay, so how do we approach a question like this? Which of the socket related system calls actually return a socket? Socket and accept. Those are the only two. Okay? The others return other things. None of the others actually return a socket at all. So the answer is socket for the client side. Connect and bind and the like. Well, bind isn't even involved. Accept isn't involved. It's socket. All right. So here's something that I find interesting about doing these little quizzes. They're not really quizzes in the sense that they're graded, but they're quizzes in that they sort of probe your knowledge. Did you notice how much better the class as a whole did on the multiple choice and true false questions than on the question where you actually had to sort of dig into your memory and come up with something. That might be interesting in your study, right? Because when you're doing the multiple choice questions, the problem that you face is sort of pattern matching on knowledge that you have. And when you have to do a question like this, you actually have to sort of dig deep and come up with the words themselves. And I noticed this over and over again with using this system in class, that I can ask the same question as a multiple choice pattern matching question or a closely related question as a fill in the blank question, and the class does quite differently. So, of course, in the real world, it's this kind of knowledge that you have to be able to produce. So work on it. Right. Now I have one that is actually much harder, I think. Which socket-related system calls return immediately? We haven't talked about this question. So you're going to have to think about the behavior of the different system calls, what they involve, and figure out which ones are going to return sort of without any interaction over the network, and which ones are going to actually have to wait for something to happen over the network. I think that's pretty much everybody. Okay. Let's talk about this one, because we didn't do so well here. So I think the best approach to thinking about this is to think about each system call individually and what it does. So what does socket do? It returns a socket for anybody. It returns a socket, right? And what do you pass to it? What do you pass to the socket system call?
The structure with the address.
No. You just tell it. You tell it what kind of socket you want, right? You tell it whether. You tell it whether you want a TCP socket. First of all, you tell it you want an IP-related socket, and then you tell it whether it's TCP or UDP. Any remote interaction involved in that? No. Okay. How about bind? What do you tell bind? What do you pass to bind? You pass a socket and a local port, right? Or more generally, a local interface of port, but just local information again. Okay? So that's just a local system call, and it associates that socket that you built with socket with that address information. Locally. No interaction. Listen. What does listen do? It just turns on a bound socket for listening. That's all that happens for listening. So all of those are returning without waiting. Okay. So we did socket, bind, and listen. What about accept? What does accept do? Where is it used, first of all? It's on the server side. And what does it make the server do? Wait for a client to show up, right? It'll just sit there until some client comes along. That's what accept does, right? So it doesn't return immediately because it's waiting. Anytime you put the word wait for in your description, it's not going to return immediately. It's going to wait for something else to happen. All right, so we did socket, bind, listen, accept. Okay, and number three, we have connect. I think everybody saw this one. What is... Hello? Why did it do that? So what does connect do? To make a connection, exactly. So it's an interaction with the server. So however long that takes is how long the client code will have to wait for connect to finish. Notice we said wait for. Okay, so it doesn't return immediately. Everybody got that one. And number four, we already dealt with connect and accept. All right? So see, this is a, although it's a deceptively simple question, it really tests your understanding of all those system calls and their behavior. And you can, and you had enough information to figure it out, even though we never talked about it before. Okay. All right. I think that's all the questions for today. But, know that there are companies out there that think this kind of level of understanding is important and actually put it on their interview standard sets of interview questions. So that's good. I was very pleased to hear this guy say, you know, I asked him, what are the system calls involved in making a network connection and using it? And this was exactly what we were going to talk about today. So that's a word of warning. And I always put some of these questions on the exam. So there you go. All right. Well, we went off and we talked about socket programming and we talked about the assignment. And I realized that we didn't actually ever finish talking about DNS and how the domain name service works. So remember, this is kind of rewinding a day or two or three, that the domain name service is the part of the internet that takes you from names like www.wsu.edu into the 4-byte numbers that actually represent internet addresses that we talked about when we talked about connect and bind and the like. Okay, so it's a service, and it is hierarchical. There are servers for different domains, and the top level. Okay, so. The proper way to write an internet, or the complete way to write an internet or DNS address is to put a dot at the end. That says this is really the end of the address. This is the highest level that you can go to. When you don't put the dot there, the DNS resolution process actually tries tacking on other things in an attempt to resolve it. But when you put a dot there, that's the full name of an entity. And each of the components here represents a level of name lookup. So when we want to look up www.wsu.edu, we have to first of all find out about the names in the top level domain, which is dot. Right? That last dot is actually a significant thing. It represents a level of name services. So from the dot domain, we could find out the authorities for the EDU domain. And we could also find out from the dot domain the authorities for COM and US and name and all the other top-level domains. Okay? So that this top-level server, dot, contains information about all the top-level domains. And we're going to see how the recursive lookup works here in just a second. And then, once we know who serves for the EDU domain, we can ask the EDU domain servers about WSU, and they will tell us, all right, who serves names for WSU, and then we can ask those name servers about where's www within that domain. All right, so it's a recursive name lookup process, conceptually. And it begins at the right end, not the left end. So typically, yeah.
Okay, so I get that. So it goes dot edu WSU, and then how does. Because the way that I thought it went was www, then to edu, and then to WSU. Just flips through the World Wide Web, and then.
No. Don't think of www as standing for World Wide Web. www is just a string of characters.
Yeah, that's
okay.
True, you could have
ECS there, or you could have clicks, or whatever. Right? So these names don't really mean anything that you see here, except go look in a certain place to find out something. Okay. So, to interact with this, remember the DNS is a distributed set of servers. To interact with these servers, we typically use a local name server that is just a caching name server. It looks up names on behalf of people and remembers the answers so it doesn't have to keep making them. Let's see. On a Windows machine, if in a command shell you type ipconfig/all, you should find out what domain server you're using. On a Linux machine, the file resolve.conf typically includes that information. So 134.121, those are sort of WSU owned name servers, and those are resolving name servers. They also serve the WSU domain, but for the purpose of looking up names of any arbitrary names, we use those to sort of do the process that I'm going to talk about next. So that's the local name server. So when I want to look up a name, like, and we'll use what they say on the slide here, gaia.cs.umass.edu, what happens? Well, it can go either of two ways. Sometimes these name servers are configured to do the work so-called iteratively, in which case the local server asks the root server for information about what? What information does the local DNS server ask the root name server for in this case? It asks it for EDU, right? So who serves EDU? And then once it knows who serves EDU, it asks one of those servers about we're looking at this address. So who is it asking this guy about? This guy up here told this guy who serves EDU. So who is he? And so now he's talking to the server for EDU. What's he going to ask about? He's going to ask about UMass, right? He gets an answer about who serves for UMass, and then the local name server asks about what? CS. And may, you know, and one thing that may happen is, actually a missing set of iteration here, it also then has to ask about Gaia within CS. The other way to configure the local server is, and the other servers within the domain actually, is to allow the servers to do a recursive query. So in that case, the host here asks the local server again for Gaia dot whatever it was, cs.umass.edu. It asks another server about the whole name, and that server takes on the task of resolving the whole name by making the queries, and things go that way. Okay? So both ways are doing it. You really wouldn't want to configure the root name servers to allow that. Right? Because remember where they sit in the hierarchy. They sit at the top, and things at the tops of hierarchies are the things that get lots of traffic. So, to prevent that lots of traffic from becoming a problem, what DNS servers do is remember the answers that they get. Caching, right? We talked about this in the case of World Wide Web, where we said maybe it's not as important as it once was because of the kind of traffic that's happening in the World Wide Web these days. DNS traffic hasn't changed. You're still looking up names. And so caching is essential in DNS to avoid overwhelming the particularly top level, particularly the root name server and the top level name servers. The root name server, think about it, how many different domains does it serve? No, actually not. No, the root name server only has to have information for things like com and edu and info and biz and all the country code domains. So a few hundred names. And think about how many of the queries that even yourself you make that involve different top-level domains. I mean, what ones do you use? You use com and edu and net and org, and probably not much more very often. So if a local name server caches the information for those top-level domains, it never has to pester the top-level name servers for the information. They just, you know, they don't get talked to except periodically to refresh the caches. But that can be you know, once every several hours for each domain. It doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to be once for every query. So when you cache something, you know, information does change. There needs to be a way for it to go away. So the way it was designed into the DNS is that there's a timeout or timestamp on the information that you receive from the top-level domain server that says how long you should believe it for. And after that amount of time has gone by, you go back and ask them again. And that's true throughout the hierarchy. What's bad about this design? This timeout design. This is a distributed systems question. Exactly. It's hard, even though it's designed to support changing, to allow things to change by forcing re-querying from time to time, a long timeout means that if you actually do change something, the clients who are trying to look that up will get the wrong answers until the timeout expires. Yes?
If you swap to somebody else, you get redirected to another server too. Like, if your IP address is swapped with another...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Right, so you get wrong answers, and it can be worse than you just don't get there. It can be that you go to the wrong place. That's definitely true. So there's some activity to deploy ways of actually forcing changes to happen so that they get noticed faster, but I'm not aware that those have actually been deployed. I certainly see problems from time to time with wrong answers. Okay, so the DNS protocol itself is organized around querying for what are called resource records. So that's what's in a DNS server, is a bunch of resource records. And they come in different flavors. The A type is the address type, and that just means that you're going to look up a host name within the record corresponds to a particular host name that has an IP address. The NS records stands for name server records, and they're the thing that glue together these different levels, right? So when you do a lookup in the top level domain of EDU, what you're looking for is an NS record that says where the name server is for EDU. Right? You're not looking up a particular host name. You're looking up information about who can answer more questions about this domain. CNAME is an alias. It's a way to have multiple names for the same machines. And mail exchange is for, you know, we address email to a person at a particular domain, not at a particular host name. So the MX record tells you what the mail server is for a particular domain. So let me do a quick example here. Okay. www.clicks.org is at 74.208. Really? That's weird. I wonder if somebody's stolen my domain name. It used to be the same. That clicks.org used to be a alias for clicks.eecs.wsu.edu. I'm going to have to check into that. But you notice here,
the second one, flix.eecs.wsu.edu, it says it's an alias for something else. And that means it has a CNAME record. Whereas VMHauser 0199 actually has an address record, an A record associated with it. So running the host command, you can sort of pick out ecs.wsu.edu. Turns out it has an address record, A record. It also is going to have some NS records, but the host command doesn't look for those. But it does look for the mail records. Mail is handled by. So those are MX records in the DNS. Okay, so you can explore the DNS with the host command. There's also NS lookup, which is interactive. Set type any, is that the one? Yes, all right. And now if we type eecs.wsu.edu, it should give us all of the records for that. So we asked our local server about our configured local server about this name, and it came back and told us who it was, first of all, and then it said, what I know about eecs.wsu is that its address is 69.166.54.55, but you shouldn't believe me necessarily. Right? It said it was a non-authoritative answer. Came from the cache. But what I do know is that you can ask these servers for authoritative information. So I think if I say server, and then say ecs.wsu.edu. Hello. Really? It won't let me ask that server?
What's the hash 53 right there?
The port number. By doing this set type equal any, I'm telling it that I want it to tell me all the records that it has for the domain. Otherwise, it just tends to return the address and mail records. That's very weird. Well, all right, I learn something every day. I've learned two things here. First of all, that I can't query ECS from the authoritative name servers using this tool, and I've learned that my Clix address may have been hijacked. So I will have to look into those two things before the day is out. Okay, the DNS protocol messages. There's a lot of detail here that I don't really want to go into. This is a binary format. But what is interesting about this protocol is that it's designed in such a way that the DNS server can take the exact buffer that contains the query and stick the answer into it just by sort of manipulating a few things. So why is that interesting? Well,
Not maybe so much these days, but when DNS was created, remember, memory was a precious resource. Machines were slow. And so if you had to copy things from one buffer into another, that meant you had to have two buffers, right, allocated, which was a pressure on the memory, and you had to do a lot of byte-by-byte copying, which was pressure on the CPU resources of the time. So by allowing the server to just fill in information in an existing buffer, it speeded up the process and made the requirements on the DNS servers much less. So this is the kind of thing that has at various times gone into protocol design, right? It's not enough that we're just answering the question. We have to be able to answer the question efficiently. Right? And what efficiently means varies as time progresses. DNS is an old protocol, and HTTP came along about 10 years later. We didn't even worry about the fact that we were using a lot of plain text stuff because the answers are huge in relation to the queries. Okay, so how does information get into DNS? Basically, how that happens is not part of the DNS specification. You can answer DNS queries from whatever sort of data source you want to. And so some people use SQL databases, some people use RADIUS servers, some people use text files. It depends on the demands of the environment that is being faced. The DNS protocol itself doesn't care. It doesn't even have any way to update anything in the DNS. So depending on what sort of data source you're using, the way you change DNS is you change text files or you change databases, and then you have to go about the process of distributing that information to the multiple servers that may serve as authoritative sources for a particular domain. So that's kind of interesting. That part of the world is not standardized, right? You just have to agree with the other folks who are serving as authoritative for your domain how you're going to exchange information with them. Okay, that's it for chapter 2. The remaining sections go over peer-to-peer applications, which you can read about. We're not going to talk about those in class, and the socket programming stuff that we did. The TCP part of from the other book, and then we will for the next assignment use UDP, and we'll talk about socket programming with UDP at that time. So I think we're just going to stop here now. I was originally thinking that we would get into chapter 3 today, but the talking about the system calls actually took longer than I thought, so that's where we are. Okay, so have a great weekend, and I will see you Monday, and Monday we will definitely do Chapter 3.
Can I ask you a question?
You may.
It's pretty good.